Dan, do you want to say something so I can just check?
Hello.
Just say hi.
Hi.
Do you know, literally, this morning when I was thinking about this, I was like, how can I legitimately get Dan to sing on the podcast?
Maybe you can sing our intro.
I was like, how can we do... I was like, how can I get in... He doesn't have the range, and then have him show me that he has the range, which is the most in joke ever, and no one else would know it or find it funny.
Darling, I've got the range.
So good. Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of A Good, Good Thing at 35 degrees, because that is the temperature that it is today and inside my house.
It is so hot. Oh my god, it's so hot. Why did we decide to record this in the middle of the day?
And the worst part is that because we are still in a coronavirus situation, that we have to be at home, and that means we are not in a soundproof room, which means we have to have the windows shut to record, which means it's just becoming this sweaty mess in my house.
I mean, it just shows the dedication that we have to bringing the world the good, good stories.
And today we have a very good, good story. I really like this story, actually. And I really like our guest, Daniel, who is one, so charismatic, but two, also doing an amazing thing.
Yeah, he is. Daniel Peters joined us, I was going to say, in the studio, over the virtual studio, to talk to us about a new project that he's launched called the Fashion Minority Report. The Fashion Minority Report aims to hold the fashion industry accountable for its diversity inclusion within its workforce. And so, yeah, we were very lucky to get to spend time with him on his busy schedule between Sky News and some other amazing outlets that he's casually been launching it on. And yeah, he talked us through what he's been getting up to, what the report is about, and what's been happening so far. So let's jump into that interview now. We got a good, 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 good thing going on. What more could we want? We are joined in the studio today by Daniel Peters, who is the ultimate multi-hyphen man. He is a menswear designer. He is a marketeer. He is an event organizer, wedding planner. Dan, what else have I got? What else have I missed?
I mean, Beyonce fan, wine drinker, trainer wearer. and I guess most recently trying to change the fashion world one brand at a time.
Indeed. Well, thank you very much for joining us today. I really appreciate you taking the time to be with us, because I think I've been really looking forward to this episode. Obviously, we know each other previously, and I just think this work that we're going to start talking about, you and the Fashion Minority Report, is amazing. And I'm really looking forward to sharing it with everyone. So yes, we're here to talk about the Fashion Minority Report, which is a new initiative that you've launched that aims to hold the fashion industry accountable for its overall kind of diversity and inclusion. And I think the best place for us to start is to kind of go through, can you lead us through the different things that have led up to you making the decision to make this a reality?
Yeah, of course. Great question to start with. I think that ultimately, Black Lives Matter as a movement is something that's massively impacted my decision to start this. You know, it's a global conversation and talking point about what's been happening to the Black community across the world. But then looking a little bit closer to home in terms of the kind of work that I do, I kind of came across something which I'd shared with you actually a few months back, about something I noticed, whereby there was a very striking image of a panel series where it features formidable talent, but that formidable talent that was showcased was an entire white panel, you know, and that's across, I think, 20 or so different talks that they'd done. 18 of the people, in my mind, were white. And looking at that, it was a very striking image of, if you're supposed to be inspiring people to join this industry, how can you only show one side of what that success looks like? It's, you know, it's really sad that for young brown or whatever other colored people there are, they might not be seeing somebody who looks like them who's successful. So those two big things combined, especially Black Lives Matter being a bigger thing, really pushed me towards wanting to create the Fashion Minority Report. And here it is now, 8 or so weeks later, after its initial kind of conversations about what I wanted to do, and now it's a thing.
I mean, yeah, that's the, I've said this to Jack, and that's the craziest thing is, just from the first time I think we spoke about this as an idea that you wanted to pursue, to you casually launching it on Sky News, where we all got up at like 6 in the morning to watch it. I was just like, who else manages this? So that is phenomenally impressive.
Thank you.
And I think very much to your point as well, is it's the, I think the first thing when kind of someone is approaching the Fashion Minority Report is that it's also not necessarily about like attacking the fashion industry. Obviously, this is also something for every industry, but it's very much obviously the world that you're in that you can help affect change in. But it's also about just providing a platform to make companies more aware. You know, we know that there's not necessarily always, it's not an active choice. It's just that people are too, because these are predominantly white institutions, they're becoming, it's too normal to just go by what they're used to, and it's trying to hold up a big placard being like, you're missing out, this is what you should be doing.
I think that it's one of those things where looking at companies and what they were posting on social media, there was some good intent behind what they were posting along with the black square, but what are you actually doing internally to address these issues? Because for myself, having worked at such amazing big companies, that's great and all. But when I look around the room, I need to be able to see other people who look like me so that I don't feel alone in that space. You know, a lot of these things that we do are all about community and the communities that we foster. And we obviously gravitate towards people who look like us in some instances. But we need to create these inclusive environments where not just one type of person is exclusively the dominant person there. And I just think, you know, as you say, fashion is obviously much closer to home for me because of my work over the past decade, which sounds ridiculous. But, you know, ultimately,
I was like, how? You're only 18.
I'm 15. But it's really, you know, just looking at something that I've worked in as an industry and as a sector, and then starting to look at the data and seeing there's an issue here, and I've already witnessed that issue being in the space. But when you dig that bit deeper and you really look into it, it's a case of just kind of going, hey, fashion brands, like, you're not doing well by people, you're not doing well by your teams and your consumer in a way as well. So I want to hold these brands accountable. And again, it's not like, this isn't cancel culture, this is really a case of, here's a solution that can help you to do better, that's quite easy for you to work with me on, and let's just do the work together. Because I know that so many brands are feeling cautious about knowing how to approach fixing issues within their company when it comes to, you know, racial diversity and female diversity and disability diversity. But actually, if you've got somebody who's bringing you a solution, as somebody who's come from the industry, grab it with both hands, grab it with all the hands that you've got, and work with people like myself.
Yeah, and I think, obviously, if we break it down, the Fashion Minority Report has 3 strategic pillars, which are commitment, transparency, and opportunity. And if we, and then I think to touch on your point about Blackout Tuesday, which was a great example of, you know, hits and misses amongst a lot of brands in a lot of industries, that's very much part of this, you know, the commitment pillar of, you know, posting that square, but not actually following it through with any sort of like robust plan or self-reflection isn't a commitment to being a part of that community and helping support it.
The 3 pillars for me were simple ways of illustrating what needs to be done towards showing that the industry is inclusive and for it to actually be more inclusive. And, you know, again, it's that element of commit to taking the pledge and commit to actually increasing the number of people of color within your teams by 5% in the next year, over the next 12 months. It's not a big number, that it shouldn't be seen as a scary number, but again, it's leveling up the playing field so that there is more equality. And then the additional pillar of transparency, because actually we don't have enough data that kind of showcases how many people work in our industry, and in particular, how many different ethnicities there are working with our industry and what jobs they're doing. And then, you know, the kind of final part about opportunity for me is, you know, one of the most fun parts, because actually it's looking at how we get young people interested and then actively into the industry, because they've been finding it difficult so far. So actually mentoring and paid internships / paid apprenticeships, very key thing, because nobody's got time to be working for free.
100%. And I think that's one where, you know, I think that's one that's also, you know, a lot of people can understand. Like, even for myself, when I started in the fashion industry, I had to internship. And I remember I worked with two girls that had both been interning for over a year, unpaid. But they came from backgrounds where their parents were able to pay their rent in a very trendy part of London. Mm-hmm. And they had credit cards. Whereas I worked a 40-hour week at the internship and then had to teach evenings and weekends to be able to afford to do the unpaid internship. Mm-hmm. And I just think, I mean, that's just a practice overall that I think is, let's just end that one completely. But it is, you know, it's very true that just like it goes so far back to that access conversation. I think even for myself as a hiring manager, for roles, it's also, you know, I've had those conversations with HRs where it's been around, you know, one, looking at the applicants that are coming forward for you, but then it's also who are they naturally going out to. It's working with your HRs to be like, you know, do you have your own biases when you're going out, and making sure that, like, you know, they're looking with a diversity inclusion mentality. Mm-hmm. But then also when you realize that if you're then seeing a position where, oh, but the candidates just aren't there, then what is it you are doing or can do to make sure that there is opportunity for them to get there? Because I think it starts even further back than that. Then it's access to courses and the right colleges and all of that kind of stuff for them to be able to get on that path and see that it's something that is open to them as well.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, first things first, I hate that narrative of, you know, the talent's not there. The talent is there, but you need to look harder to find it, to nurture it, to grow it, and to kind of enable it. Like, the talent's there. Like, I really despise that narrative of there not being enough of the right people there from a particular section of people, for instance. And for me, HR is really the place where I'm looking to start these conversations, because HR is the kind of gatekeeper to a company, as it were, or especially in terms of the hiring process. And there's something I've been reading up about recently, which is unconscious bias. And obviously, you know, that's got a great deal of, sorry, or how can I rephrase that? It's really about picking people who are similar to you. We do that in every kind of walk of life. And actually, we're seeing that that's something that's so often done in the workplace. Picking another Steve who looks like a Steve and picking another Becky who looks like a Becky. No offense to Beckys and Steves, but, you know, we pick people who are like us, and actually we need to buck that trend. And it's one of those things where, for me, why I've been able to work in a number of places is because of the way that I sound and because my name's Daniel. That's not to say that I haven't come across different biases, but I pass is the thing. And being able to pass shouldn't be somebody's only entry into a company, no matter whether there's prestige around that company or not. You should be able to pick me for the role based on how good I am at doing it. And, you know, I think that, again, as I say, HR is the first port of call that I'm kind of looking to connect with companies, or their kind of new diversity hires that are being parachuted into different companies right now, because I've never seen so many diversity and inclusion specialist roles come up at one time on LinkedIn in my entire life. It's kind of, you know, it's crazy, but hiring one person to manage that internally isn't going to be the fix. You know, one of the things I'm taking into companies is that if you're going to have a diversity and inclusion specialist, make that a team in general, and make that team be varied in terms of seniority within the company, and making sure that you've got different sexes, or different genders, I should say, and different ages as well, because age is one thing that, you know, yes, we like to think that age is experience, but at the same time, young people have experience in some way, and they should feel included in conversations.
Yeah, and I think what you know, even if it's you know, obviously budgets or whatever, even if there's a if there's a single person that is hired to be almost like the organizer and point guard on it, it's the fact that like no single person's still going to be able to do it. They then have to pull together a network through the business. And I think my one of the best things I've heard you say in the interviews you've given about Fashion Minority Report is that you're not everyone's black search engine. Which is just my favorite phrase ever, but it's so true, because it's also that, you know, it's the across the board tokenism. It's like, I wouldn't be there for diversity as like a gay man to talk about all diversity. You're not there as a black person to talk about it for all ethnic minorities. And it stands the same. You have to connect it through your network. Like, fair enough if you can say that you can't afford to hire a team, but you then need to be making sure that you are creating a network through seniority, through races and through ages, to make sure that like everything is being accounted for, so that you can kind of make sure that you're guiding your policies in the correct way.
Yeah, again, and that's the thing, it's like when I say having a team of people in place, it's not going out and hiring an entire new team to do that. Use people internally, because actually it's company culture which is where a lot of this starts, and that's where the conversations happen. So having your team who are already there working with this new person who is the diversity and inclusion lead. So actually, when I think about it, it's not a case of hiring an entire new team to come in and do diversity and inclusion. It's utilizing the team that you've already got in place, because they obviously know the company culture and they can give you feedback and opinions on how to change that or make it better. So that they can work with that new diversity inclusion lead that you've got. And to your point about, you know, my recent comment, which is going on a t-shirt soon, I am not your black search engine. 100,000,000%. I think that companies need to be cautious of not just pulling every single black member of staff into a room and going, so tell us about your experience. No, you can learn from some of those experiences, but you also need to do the work yourself. We have Google, we have libraries, we have different resources. There's enough on social media right now for us to all be able to take something from it and learn. I myself am learning throughout this process about things that I didn't really know about when it came to race. I'm also having to speak to myself about the things that I've kind of just allowed to kind of pass me by. Racial things and so on, and no more of that. I need to be accountable myself. People of different races need to be accountable for what they see and for what they do and how they treat people. But you know, yeah, do the research, do the work.
I think one thing to go back to the ideas of commitment and the I think some of the stats that the website pulls out that I think are incredibly interesting is how there's so many layers to the company of this almost like performative allyship or the optical allyship, because it starts with, did you just post a square with no kind of plan? Mm-hmm. It's then, I think one thing that's happening in a lot of conversations are brands that are, on the outside, campaigns are super diverse. I feel like a lot of brands are at this stage where they know that if you put a cast lineup of white people, that's just never going to fly with anyone anymore. But actually, it goes so much further than that, because it's like, you know, let's spin the camera around. And there's been some brands in the news in the last few weeks that have had it, where you spun the camera around and they've done, here's our team's crew selfie shot. And you realize that the entire production team, like that, you know, the DOP, the like everything, are all white.
Yep.
And it then becomes this absolute performative thing that isn't really helping solve the issue.
Yeah, it's like a game of Where's Wally, like spot the brown person. And that's my entire experience of coming from big companies. And, you know, it's a shame, and it's something we need to work on. And yes, you know, the big Parisian fashion brand who hired a black cast, wonderful, darling, applause, great. But what does it look like in 6 months? What does it look like in 2 seasons, 3 seasons, when actually Black Lives Matter isn't trending? It's kind of like, yeah, what I'm now calling blackwashing, i.e. Putting a black band-aid on something for a hot minute, and then actually that black band-aid is going to fall off because it's not able to hold together all of the rubbish that you've been kind of putting out there in a kind of haphazard way.
And that's to your point on that's for everyone. It's like black isn't a trend, so doing it for one season because it's of the moment in conversation. Disability isn't a trend. Putting someone down the runway with crutches or a wheelchair for a one-off spectacle is not solving the issue and is not actually supporting any sort of change.
It needs to be continual. It needs to not be a second thought because of it gaining you more likes and more followers. It needs to be something that is ingrained within your company, that you want to be the change. You want to be the change that we see. Don't just do it because it's, again, as you say, it's performative. In 2 years' time, I'll be knocking on your door again saying, okay, so what are the stats? Where are we at? This isn't just a campaign that's for this hot minute. This is something whereby businesses need to be looking at this continuously. And I'm here to be that person that's going to be looking at it with them supportively. Is supportively a word? Maybe, I think so.
I support your use of it.
Okay. Thank you kindly. But yeah, you know, again, I want to be an ally to these brands as much as they want to be an ally to Black people. So again, let's do the work together. Like, let's make the change that we want to see.
Definitely. And I think the other important thing that you do say is that also that it comes within every level. And I think that seniority conversation is really important, that you know, the next stage after you've done the casting and then your production team, it's then looking at the hierarchy of your company. And actually, you know, there are some companies that if you just simply looked at the overall employee population could look like a very diverse company. Mm-hmm. But when you suddenly put that on a spotlight of senior management, upper level management, C-suite, the picture completely changes.
Yeah.
And I think that's to your point of, you know, that's from people of color, but that's also women as well. In as much as fashion, you know, it has a lot, women have a stronghold in a lot of areas of fashion, it's still the minority compared to men. And when you start going up to the big parent companies and the big fashion houses, it goes back to being completely white male dominated.
Oh yeah. I mean, again, like we're seeing that, like I'm continuously having to hear about these firsts which are happening, i.e. that, you know, Rihanna having her Fenty brand is the first female-led, Black-owned luxury fashion house kind of in Paris ever, kind of in like a Kering space. Or is it Kering or is she Richemont, whichever one it is. But then also people like Afua Hirsch with Why I'm No Longer Talking to People About Race. I think that's the book out of these ones. But she's the first Black British author to have the number one spot as a woman ever because of what's happened with BLM. And I'm like, it's 2020, how is that a first?
And it becomes that thing of like, you're kind of, I want to applaud this, but I'm also like, my jaw is on the floor with kind of like, as if we're celebrating this, like you should all be like creeping in the corner with embarrassment that, like, you know, it's been what, it was in the last 5 years where we've had like the first Black actress for winning an Emmy, and like, you know, this is just happening, like actually.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it's such a an odd feeling, isn't it, where you obviously you want to scream and shout and celebrate it, but you're also like, but this is the example of how much more work needs to be done.
Exactly.
Like, we're still having the problem of like whitewashed nominations lists.
Yeah.
You know, we've seen that, we've seen that in the recent Emmy nominations and with regards to the trans cast of Pose, again, completely ignored, yet critically acclaimed performances. And I think that goes into that unconscious bias. And actually, to slightly segue back onto the things about seniority, I actually think that unconscious bias also plays a really important role across the board with the further issues that we have around like diversity inclusion through hierarchy. What I have seen in companies is where you'd have like, you start seeing it out in pockets. So where, and this is like white people, Black people, Hispanic, Indian, where if that's the hiring manager, that team goes out into that area through their unconscious bias. Mm-hmm. And then you kind of see how the pockets form across different areas of a business.
Yeah, they do. And again, I think, you know, the first step for a company is to really take a deep dive and a look into what their companies look like internally across the board, across every single level of the business, from the boardroom right the way down to the most junior of roles. What does the entire business look like? And that's something that I'll be offering as part of the service for Fashion Minority Report with the businesses who come on board and take the pledge, that we will go in and do a survey of what the business looks like racially diverse and diverse, diversely, that's not a word, in a diverse
term. I support that too.
And then understanding how people feel about the company culture, you know, that's the kind of second step of what we'll be going in and doing, just so businesses and brands and the senior managers can really understand how people feel about the companies that they're employed by, so that we can then look to readdress those pillars for, you know, inclusion and what that really looks like for the business moving forward. Because, you know, so that we don't end up with more scandals, because obviously in like The Guardian today, there's the whole article about Italy being called out for its lack of racial diversity in the fashion industry. And they were called up on that ages ago. I mean, I think even Prada is still having, and you know, Prada's a very diverse brand, but I think Naomi Campbell was one of the first black women to front one of their campaigns recently enough, or something to that effect. And it's just like, again, why are these things like first? Why am I in 2020 and so many of these things are first? You know, considering when I look at the history of who was the person to invent hair conditioner, it was a black woman. Who was the person who invented CCTV? It was a black woman. Who invented the ironing board? It was a black woman. Did I know about any of this until this year? No, but actually these inventions were made up many years ago. But again, I've never been told about them. I've been told about Christopher Columbus sailing seas, which that's no benefit to me. Like,
it's true. But then, do you know what? Actually, you saying about hair care as well, and mentioning hair, that... it reminds me of something that I was reading about, you know, and this ties into the, you know, the pillar of opportunity, not just from how we're helping access mm-hmm. an opportunity, but it's also that this is an opportunity for brands. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, everyone, it's a business. These are businesses, but like, this is about like, you're ignoring entire areas of people. And, you know, obviously we could go into 15 podcast lengths to talk about like, how these brands dip into like the cultural appropriation, but then they're not representing it on the inside. But they're, you know, it's by getting these diverse voices in, it's opening up opportunities for the brands. I was reading that the black beauty industry is worth like 88 million in the UK. Black women are like spend six times more on like things like hair care than white women do.
Yeah, we've got to keep those like, afros, you know, greased.
It's just like, you know, and they are like, you know, they set these beauty trends, and it's kind of, you know, so that this isn't just, you know, telling a business to do obviously simply what's right. It's also just, it makes business sense. Like the more voices you have and the more diverse and truly genuinely inclusive you are as a company, the broader your audience is going to be.
Exactly.
And that's, it's a win all round.
Exactly. It's not a bad, like, again, like you look at what somebody say, like Rihanna's done with Fenty Beauty, and how that opened or changed the game of beauty, you know, by having so many shades and ranges that all of the big brands had been, apart from kind of say MAC, but a lot of the big brands have been neglecting for so long. And then Rihanna comes in and owns it and owns that space with all of these shades that accommodate to different people's skin tones. And it's like, okay, now everybody's going to try and jump on that. And mm-hmm. try and climb on the, you know, coattails of Rihanna. And she's been doing that again then with her lingerie range and stuff like that. But I just think it's high time that we celebrate diverse voices and we pay them their dues and we show them the respect that they deserve. You know, there's enough space in the world to celebrate more than, again, just the Beckys with the good hair. You know, we need to, I got a Beyonce reference and I'm like, yes.
Just trying to get through them.
Every single thing I'm doing, I'm like, just mention Beyonce at some point and then she'll hear this. But again, it's just, you know, even looking at what Beyonce is doing with the release of her new Black is King. And it's just a celebration of blackness. It's, you know, it's not being against white people. It's a celebration of our skin and our beauty and our uniqueness. And I think that's wonderful. Yeah. But yeah, brands need to really step it up in order to support and to, you know, again, like you actually said before, like it widens the reach and it brings more people to your table in an office sense, but it also brings more people to your shops. And no, we shouldn't be just looking at things from a profit perspective, but even through the research I've been doing at looking at different McKinsey reports, and you know, some of the stats are that productivity and business profits are increased by kind of 36% in a company that has more racial diversity in their teams. And that in a statement alone should be encouraging people to run to hire more diverse talent within their teams.
Yeah, I mean, that's also a great example where, I mean, I've worked at companies where I've sat in a room where the discussion topic was around tackling the Middle Eastern and Chinese markets. And you're there being like, we're all white British people.
Yeah.
Like, do we not want to kind of do any sort of outreach to China, or like, you know, work with consultants that actually like are of these communities, are you know, live in these countries, rather than just what we assume from our own experience. And I think it's kind of getting to a place where people at every level need to walk into those rooms and be like, this isn't what we should be seeing. To make those changes.
No, definitely. And I think, again, that's the point. And just by having more diverse voices at the table, you're getting different viewpoints, so that actually we don't have more slip-ups like the H&M cheeky monkey t-shirt incident, and little things like that. And it's just, again, you're being able to make better, more informed decisions by having more unique voices at the table who all come from different walks of life. Because, you know, I'm the Black man from a single parent family, working class Peckham, who's going to have a different viewpoint on something and have an opinion on something that's different to, say, my colleague who lives in Chelsea or lives in Hammersmith or in East London or something. So having all of these different voices only contributes towards having a more informed decision, so that you put out better work.
And what's been the initial reaction to the Fashion Minority Report since you launched it?
It's been such an amazing response since it launched, actually. It's been better than I could have hoped for in that sense. And it's you know, it's really amazing. It's had some traditional media pickup, which has been wonderful. I think I should be in a local paper today, South London Press. I'm going to go pick that up afterwards. But just looking at the industry itself, I've been having some really positive conversations with brands who are interested in taking the pledge and actually coming on the journey of understanding their business better, and being able to bring in fresh talent, because ultimately I'm providing them with a resource of young people who come from lower socioeconomic backgrounds who have not been able to find their way into the industry, but are very thirsty and hungry to do the work. So by being able to do more cohorts as time goes on, I'm hopefully getting more people a seat at different tables and different organizations. And I think that's really amazing that brands are willing to come on board and do the work. And I'm talking to, you know, a couple of luxury brands, and I'm talking to some really big fashion corporate companies. And that's amazing to know that just within 3 weeks of it having launched, that there are some positive conversations coming out of it.
So this project's been like actively running, I guess, for 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. And would you say, like, what kind of really practical examples can you give the people listening of how you've begun to have those conversations with companies?
So I guess in a way I'm starting to work off of my network and reaching out to people in companies that I already know or have some kind of association or affiliation with, and just kind of saying, hey, I'm doing this thing and it would be great to talk to you. And just kind of showing them what traction it's gained so far, because obviously that helps to sometimes get people over the line a little bit. But I must say that actually, whoever I do start to mention it to, they've been incredibly receptive, and you know, they're very much of that nature of, this is so needed. Actually, this is a really great way of tackling the issue. So I've been very fortunate in that position that I've been able to start talking to people in different businesses that I've either worked with in the past and they're in new companies, and get that ball rolling in some way. So that's been quite nice.
Yeah, it must be amazing to start this thing and then put it out there and to already be receiving these kind of really nice feedback, not just from the community, but for people who you are actually trying to interact with.
Oh, definitely. I mean, it's overwhelming in some ways because, you know, you think of something in your room one night about how you can try and create change, and then it's out there after, you know, kind of 7 or 8 weeks, and you've very much done a lot of the work on your own with the support of friends who've read things on my behalf and so on to make sure I'm getting the tone right. But it's really great to see people's reactions, and actually just from general public actually liking and commenting on things. And, you know, I was reached out to by a young lady who is blind but loves fashion, and she, you know, she had an opinion on how good this was as a starting point, but she wanted to make sure that I don't forget about disability in the conversations. And I think that's very much something that I'd like to tackle as well, but I've got to start with small steps. I can't run before I walk.
Yes, you just need to tackle racial equality, the small step, and then you can move on.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that really small thing, racial inequality.
So what is your ideal outcome for this? Like, if you were to imagine the fashion industry in 50 years after this has had its best possible change, how do you see that fashion industry?
Jesus. Big question. I think that ultimately government needs to play a part in some kind of reporting structure for how we talk about diversity. It's something that's been done for the gender pay gap, where there is a site where companies with over 200 or 250 employees need to legally disclose what the gender pay gap is. I think on one hand, that needs to be, that number needs to be lessened. Actually, it should be anybody with more than 25 employees, for instance. But then ultimately they need to do something for the diversity space where companies need to record and report what that information is, and I'm here to lobby for that to become something, so that it's down and it's locked in and it's something that won't change, so that everybody's held accountable, really.
Great. That sounds huge.
I suppose also an important question is for listeners who want to support the Fashion Minority Report, what can they do to get involved and show their support?
So, I mean, you know, you can head over to fashionminorityreport.com and you can add your signature. We also have an Instagram page. And as we move forward with things, we will be kind of asking for anybody who's following it to shout about the brands that they want to take the pledge that they already shop with. Because, you know, I think that as consumers, we have power in understanding how our brands are on the inside, not just what they put out on the inside. So we need to hold brands accountable in that sense. So I think come on the ride with us, which sounds weird and funny, but, you know, come on this journey with us, because it's not just, this isn't just a one-time thing. This is something that will create kind of real systemic change within the fashion industry, I feel. And it's great to have consumers and industry professionals alike celebrate this with me.
Amazing. Well, if there's anyone that can make this happen, out of anyone that I know, it is definitely you.
Oh, stop
it. So, you know, I think it's going to be a really exciting year to come and so on from then.
Thank you very much. No, I'm really looking forward to it. And I think that actually the work with Creative Mentor Network is going to be really exciting, and pulling in all of the fashion professionals to become mentors, and also making sure that we've got a diverse span of mentors as well, is going to be really exciting. And looking at what we can start to do by taking it into schools and colleges as well, once we're allowed to next year. So I think it's a really exciting time. And I must say that with the schools and colleges, it won't just be London-based, because I'm a little bit fed up of everybody thinking that London is the epicenter of cool and where everything happens when it comes down to fashion. So I want to make sure that we're going regionally and not just staying within our doorstep to hopefully inspire some young people.
I had one more, which I didn't write down, but I think I have now forgotten. What was it? It was something... Ah, it was really insightful and interesting of a question. And I'm sure the answer is going to be...
Was it going to be, what's my favourite Beyoncé song?
What's your favourite Beyoncé song?
I mean, I surely couldn't pick one. I love all of them.
Well, you guys can chat amongst yourselves while I think of what this question was. It was just something that it was to do with being like, an angle about the positivity going forward and the energy. And maybe Neil, you can think of what that question might be. You know, so when people get to the end of the podcast interview, they feel like really super upbeat about the future of this, but it's totally gone from my brain. So
I kind of get where you're going. I mean, I am super pumped about what the future holds for this, because actually it affects change, and the change is bigger than me, and it's outside of me, and it's for people. And that's ultimately what's really amazing for me, for what I'm doing. A lot of what I've done in the past is to make businesses richer that I work for, and we sell really pretty clothes and stuff like that. And, you know, yes, I'm a menswear designer and I've got clothes to sell, but at the same time, I want to make fashion a more inclusive space for young people who are coming up, for young people who might feel as if the industry isn't accommodating towards them because they look different or they sound different. And I want to break down those barriers. So for me, I'm so pumped about the people I'm going to get to work with, the young people that we're hopefully going to be able to inspire to look at taking up a career in fashion. And I'm happy and fortunate that I get to be a bit of a spokesperson for this. And again, it means I get to meet really cool, awesome new people and talk to people about really fun things. And hopefully those words could resonate with somebody and they could see a career in fashion as a possibility because of the Fashion Minority Report.
You know what? Hearing you say that, it makes me think there's actually two really wonderful things that's going on here, right? One is the Fashion Minority Report. And the second is the fact that you've been able to find it in yourself amongst all the other responsibilities in life to put out your time and energy to create something, not just with positive intentions, but also having positive outcomes. Mm-hmm. And I guess what I wanted to ask as well was, had you done anything like this before or in any field? Or is this you were thinking, okay, now is the time I can make a positive change and I'm going to do it. And you've been able to do it as an individual amazingly.
thank you. No, that's really kind to say. I mean, I will say, which I've said to a few friends, the Fashion Minority Report was originally supposed to just be a podcast where I got to talk to diverse voices from within the fashion industry. And that's coming. But ultimately, it's kind of snowballed into this amazing beast. And it's a beast that I didn't think I would ever be at the helm of. You know, I do care about activism, but I never saw myself as launching a campaign about activism, especially about race. So, you know, as I edged nearer to the launch date of it, I was a bit like, wow, this is actually happening and this is something I'm doing. And I didn't think that I had it within me to be that person, in the sense of I guess I just dug deep and I found this buzz to try and create change. And hopefully that is what's going to happen. And it's just super exciting that I get to be a bit of a spokesperson for it. And, you know, yeah, just try and make change in that way.
You built your own stage.
And actually I did it. I was just going to say,
so for anyone that doesn't know that reference, if anyone watched all of the YouTube commencement speeches by famous people that Michelle and Barack Obama organized in the summer, Beyonce's one had this moment where she's talking to kind of like anyone who considers themselves othered. And she says, just like, if you can't get on the stage, build your own stage. And Dan and I were watching it and basically just like the bottom fell out from underneath us when she says it. And we were just like, that's it. We're going to change the world. And Dan did it. Dan is a lot further along the line.
No,
but... Whereas I'm just like, I don't know what to have for breakfast still.
Neil, you're stuck on the podcast, right? You didn't go beyond.
I mean, look, you're doing the work here. And actually that's so true. Like I watched that, you watched that. And I was a bit like, wow, actually, that's so right. And then I put a post on my Instagram, however many weeks ago that would have been. And I think that was really the catalyst of the, you know, day-wise that made me go, oh, okay, I'm going to do this now. So that was, yeah.
Where it jumped from the podcast to the actual initiative.
I mean, 26th of June was when I posted that. If it doesn't exist, build your own platform. And as it says, currently living by these words that I heard in the video by the one and only Beyonce. And it really has manifested into that. Wow, I hadn't even thought about that for a few weeks.
I love it. And the thing is, like, you know, we laugh about referencing someone like Beyonce, but it is still like a monumental example of someone who, you know, oh, do you know what? I meant to look it up to get the exact award ceremony. I think it was the CFDA when she won the award for Fashion Icon. Mm-hmm. And she gave this incredible speech where actually in front of all of these like creative directors and stuff, she talks about how at the start of Destiny's Child, none of the people in that room would dress her. No one wanted to provide them anything. Tina Knowles created everything. And it was only when, you know, she became bigger, they were interested, but she was just like, she started forging her own way. And it was like, you can work with me, but you'll do it how I want it. Not like, I'm not just going to slip into your campaign type thing. And the thing is, like, yes, she's Beyonce, but like, that is a monumental example to anyone in that, like, you build it and then one, the people come, but also you can make the rules and make the right change happen.
Oh no, completely. Like, one, like, she gave them the receipts at that award ceremony, and she was wearing that amazing black dress and the black hat, which I think was based on the Formation video, and she read them the rights, but not in a way of, I'm going to drag you again, this isn't cancelling, but actually, you didn't pay attention to me. And actually, through my family and through my network, we were able to cobble together one of the biggest selling girl bands of all time. And it was only a particular point that I was deemed good enough to be able to wear your product.
It's like you said, the talent was there. The talent was there, and they weren't paying attention, and they weren't...
She had the range. Yeah,
she definitely has the range. They were not... no one was there, like, you know, like, extending a hand out, giving opportunity. And it was only once she'd done... Her and the band and the family had done all of the work themselves to smash through... that someone was like suddenly like, oh, okay, I want a piece of that. And it's like,
yeah, of course. I mean, it's I guess it's just a shame that we still hear of those instances happening. I think it's Leslie Jones, who was in the Ghostbusters film, who is, publicly said on so many occasions that she's been turned away from design houses because they can't accommodate to her body. It's fabric, make it work. I don't see what the issue is. Like, is it because you don't think I'm the right person for your brand? If that's what it is, just say that. But don't tell me that you can't make the fabric work, because it is fabric, hun. And you can make that work on anybody, shape, size. Like, that's it.
And that's it. Like, we've spent so long just accepting these excuses. And actually, in my notes, I'd put about how, you know, it's so easy just to kind of stay as it is. And brands there's a lot of brands and people within their own lives where it's hard to force yourself out of what is normal. And, you know, people are like, people get worried when it's like, you know, that it could be tokenism of like, you know, we're like, okay, let's make sure that it's diverse. But there's also an element where, well, actually it has to be like mandated to that point where, until it becomes second nature and your unconscious bias has left, like, you have to actively be working at this. And fashion has had a million and one excuses. And it actually reminds me of an interview I watched with Gina Rodriguez, who plays Jane the Virgin, the actress, where she, you know, she talks about how there were magazines that like had kind of told her to like lose weight, or, you know, they were like, oh, we're just not sure we could put you on the cover. And she just goes, do you know how you shoot a cover for a magazine? You stick me in a studio, you take a picture, you print that shit, and you put it on a mag rack. Like, and it's like, yeah, that is exactly how you make a magazine. Like, you know, there is nothing, there's nothing about her body that makes her not able to be on the front of a magazine. And I just think it's it's the reckoning of that, those excuses no longer being viable.
It's the awakening. Yeah. And, you know, for me, I've kind of said to myself, I'm no longer going to be complicit in this bias that's happening in companies and outside of it. And I'm going to call it out, because it's high time that everybody be held accountable for their BS. So no more complicit, Daniel, at any point.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, I think that's actually a pretty great place to end it, everyone. Stop being complicit. If you don't do something, you're complicit. End. Done.
Right.
Stop it, edit it, print that shit, publish it. but yeah, I mean, Daniel, you know I love you. Thank you very much for coming and chatting to us. What you're doing is amazing. And I'm really excited to see where it's going to go. And I think it's only got one direction to go, and that is up.
Damn straight. No, thank you so much for having me. And thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about the Fashion Minority Report. And again, for anybody listening, please head over to the fashionminorityreport.com website to get more information about the project. And again, thank you for having me. We got a good
thing going on. What more could we want? Ah, that was so good. Dan is brilliant, isn't he?
He is brilliant. And can I just say, blows excellent air kisses.
He does. If only everyone could have seen it. But I just think the biggest thing I need to reiterate is just how fast he did this. Like, honestly, he messaged a group of friends and was like, this is something I want to do. This is the idea I'm having. And like he said, started off as the podcast. And then it was just boom, boom, every week, massive developments, new people he's in conversations with. Then it was this huge initiative. Like, Dan is ultimate inspiration goals on that, like, if you want it, you can make it happen. And yeah, I think it's brilliant. And as he said, everyone should be going to fashionminorityreport.com to add your signature and to find out more, and share it with your friends, share it with your colleagues, share it with your bosses, share it with your bosses' bosses, so that we can spread the news far and wide.
Yeah, and one more thing about Daniel, because Fashion Minority Report is awesome in itself, but just the idea, and we see this with lots of the people that we get on to this show, like the fact that people just can choose to actively spend time working to make a difference and then be able to enact that difference on the world is such like an amazing message that people can take away, right? Is that you can make these changes just by coming up with an idea about something you're passionate about and dedicating your time to it. And that's like a huge good thing, really.
So that's it for this week's episode. I hope you all enjoyed it. That's really all I've got left to say. And we will see you for the next episode really soon. Bye.
Bye-bye.
We've got a good thing. You didn't get him to sing the theme.
Ah, son of a bitch.